Until our century, the word Lebanon designated the mountain range which largely enfolds the Orontes River, southwestern Syria, as it flows swiftly down to the Mediterranean Sea. The Lebanons, the anti-Lebanons, as they're sometimes called, are a mountain range. They rise swiftly out of the coastal plain, a very narrow plain, along the Mediterranean, and they give off rather quickly again to the Syrian plateau behind. They're among the tallest of the mountain peaks in this part of the world. Lebanon, Lebanon, Lavan, white, the white-covered mountains. They're familiar from antiquity. They're referred to many times in our Bible. King Solomon sent to the Lebanon, the mountains, the great cedars whose beams he used as ceiling beams for the temple in Jerusalem, the Arzei HaLebanon. The prophet Jeremiah used the snow-capped peaks of Lebanon for one of his most telling symbolic illustrations of the, in which he contrasted the constancy of nature and the inconstancy of Israel. Do the fields change their stones? Does the Lebanon change its snow? Do the brooks cease to run? But my people have turned against me. From ancient times, the Lebanon was ruled as one of the districts of Syria. It had little political identity of its own. Whether it was the Greek kingdoms after Alexander the Great, or the Romans, or the kingdoms of the Caesars, or the later Islamic kingdoms, the Lebanon was not an individual country with a personality of its own. But what was called Coalesced Syria, the lower, the eastern Syria, the western Syria, a district, a prefecture of the larger whole. It had a personality all of its own, for largely it could not be governed. 90% of the land is mountainous, and the mountains rise swiftly. They are craggy and stony. This was the kind of country to which those who were fleeing the police came, whether they were deserters from Alexander the Great's armies or from Caesar's armies, whether they were the Monothelites or the Maronite Christians fleeing the fanaticism of Byzantine Orthodoxy, whether they were the Druzes and the Shiite Muslims fleeing from the sword of Islam. For whatever reasons, those who needed to escape came, bandit and heresiarch, freebooter and pious saint. They came and each found his own little valley, his own little rill, his own highland, and he fortified it against the police, against the government, against his neighbors. And conservatism, secrecy, religious labels have been a major element in Lebanese life ever since. This is a country of small groups of people determinedly holding on to their identity against all others, against all those outside. But there are two sides to the Lebanon. For beneath these tall hills, this mountain fastness, is a small, narrow coastal plain which is dotted by a number of ports, which among these Sidon, Tripoli, Tyre, cities which since the first millennium before the Common Era have been among the most international of the seaports of the world. It was here that the Phoenicians had their commercial center. They took the Arzei HaLebanon, the cedars of the Lebanon, and they used them for the tall masts of their ship with which they went half the world round. And they brought back to the Lebanon the goods, the folkways, the ideas of a good half of the world. And so Lebanon has always been of two minds. The one mind, the coastal mind, open to the world, commercial, sophisticated. The other mind, the mind of the hill folks, protective, conservative. And these two minds have lived in uneasy coalition in this little piece of world ever since. Now, the nation Lebanon was created in the French Foreign Office early in this century. During the 19th century, French imperial interests began to establish commercial footholds in Syria and in the area we call Lebanon. And during the First World War, as the French Foreign Office began to think through what it wanted as booty from the war, it decided that among its most important demands to be pressed at Versailles was a demand that Syria and Lebanon should become protectorates of France. And so it turned out to be. But the French also decided, for many reasons, that the Lebanon should be cut apart, cut off from Syria, and ruled independently, given a political identity of its own. And so it was at Versailles, Lebanon for the first time became a proto-state. It had no foreign office, it had no independence, but it was to be a political configuration. Now, why did the French do this? In the first instance, the Lebanon was, by Middle Eastern standards, well-to-do, and Syria was terribly poor. And they didn't want to mix the poverty and the little bit of wealth for fear that the problems of Syria would despoil the economic advantages of the Lebanon. In the second instance, the Lebanon represented the only area in the Middle East in which the Christians were a majority, albeit a slight one. Lebanon remains today about 53% Christian, some 46% Muslim. And so the French felt, French Catholic France felt, that in order to protect the missionary interests and the Catholic interests in the Lebanon, it was necessary to protect these people from being engulfed in the flood tide of Islam. Whatever the reasons, France created the Lebanon as a nation. And between 1921 and 1939, Lebanon waxed rich for a Middle Eastern nation under French hegemony. The Lebanese standard of living doubled again. Western missionary interests brought higher education to the Lebanon and mass literacy. The Catholics established the University of St. Joseph in Beirut. American Protestantism established the American University in Beirut. And the graduates of these schools were encouraged by all kinds of funds to go to the Sorbonne and to Oxford and to Harvard and to Oberlin, where we received some of the best education in the West. The Lebanon was to be for Europe, for America, what Liberia was in Africa. The very, very model of what Western technology and Western faith could do for the benighted heathen. And there was one advantage in the Lebanon. Most Lebanese were not heathen. They were Christian. And so you could bring one of these very nice, good-looking young men and young women into your home. They spoke French, the sophisticated language of the world. They spoke English because they needed it to come to America, to the university. They could go to church with you. They seemed very, very Western, very, very eager to please. And you had a very pleasant sense that, in fact, all those fine missionary sermons that you'd heard over all those years were bearing fruit. Now, the Second World War was an embarrassment for the French and for the Lebanese. It turned Vichy Frenchmen against the Free Frenchmen. They fought over the Lebanon. And the Lebanese, who rather respected the French because French hegemony prevented the Muslim population and the Christian population from being at one another's throats. The Lebanese native population was suddenly faced during the years of the Second World War with making some unwanted political choices between the Allies and the Axis, between the Free French and the Vichy French, between remaining a French protectorate and independence. Some of the issues were decided for them. But the issue of independence they had to accept, whether they wished it or not, because many of the young people particularly were insisting that every nation must determine its own destiny, that Lebanon must follow the way of the world and proclaim its freedom. And so after a number of years of half-hearted negotiation, the Lebanese finally accepted and took their freedom in 1946. And a very tenuous balance of power was developed, an agreement in Lebanon, which saw to it that the two great religious traditions would not be continuously at one another's throats. The head of state was to be a Christian. The premier was always to be a Shiite Muslim. And that's the way things have been in the Lebanon ever since. But the very reasons that Lebanon was first carved out as an independent entity began to work against the Lebanon when it became simply another small Near Eastern state. In the first instance, the French implosion of wealth, of advantage into the Lebanon had made it a very desirable plum. And the Syrians, the poor, just across the border, began to look with covetous eyes on all the wealth of Beirut. They wanted it. And they began to say to one another, the Lebanon was always part of Syria. Let's have revanche. Let's take it back unto our own. Lebanon has lived with Syrian subversion for the last 20 years. And Americans have good reason to remember that subversion because it was the money sent in by Syria and the guns sent in 1958, which precipitated a general strike, which brought down the Lebanese government, which precipitated President Eisenhower to send in again our Marines to the shores of Tripoli. The Lebanese government has lived a very shaky life in the years since it's become independent. For not only are the Syrians sitting across its northern and its eastern border, sending in arms, sending in spies, sending in saboteurs, sending in propaganda, but the Arab world, as you know, has been in ferment. And the Arab world has adopted, part of the Arab world has adopted the philosophy of the third world, of massive Chinese, Cuban type of social revolution. The Lebanon represents the West, capitalism, imperialism. Its banks are attuned to the banks of Switzerland, to the Bourse in France, towards London. And the third world wants to throw over this last vestige of Western imperialism, so they too, the guerrillas of the battles of these last several weeks, they too have been eager to join in the subversion of the Lebanon, in forcing the Lebanon to turn to the Orient, to become another Byzantine state. And as Russia has moved further and further into the dominant position in the Middle East, she too has had reason to want to cut the ties of the Lebanon with the West, to force Lebanon to become another one of the small states that depend upon Russian largesse for their military power. The Lebanese then have lived with restive, subversive Arab neighbors for the last 20 years. Lebanese security has been shaky. There have been constant trials in Lebanon of this member of the government or that member of the military who has been bought off by Egypt, by Iraq, by Syria, by the guerrillas, whose loyalty is really to them and not to the Lebanese. What I'm trying to say is this, that if we look at the events of the last several weeks, the battles between the El Fatah, Arafat's guerrillas, and the Lebanese government, simply in the terms in which they're presented in the public press, in terms of a demand by the El Fatah that they be given a greater freedom of movement in the Lebanon in order to attack Israel more easily, and an unwillingness of a neutralist government, the Lebanese, to grant that freedom of attack because presumably they're scared of Israeli reprisal, we won't have understood what's going on. We'll see it in an inadequate and incorrect perspective. The guerrillas, the El Fatah, have had for the last 2 years complete freedom of movement along the whole border between Israel and the Lebanon. The Hashbani River runs about 15 miles north of the Israeli border. And apparently the line of demarcation which had been agreed on between the guerrillas and the Lebanese was that the guerrillas could operate between the Hashbani and the border with complete freedom and impunity. That they could receive from Syria all of the guns which they required, mortars and the like, and that no one would interfere in their activity. The guerrillas, in brief, have had all the freedom to operate against Israel that if they solely were concerned with those operations, they would require. But the issue is this. Can the Lebanese break open the eastern border? Can the Syrians break open the eastern border of the Lebanon so they can move into the central Lebanon and to northern Lebanon, the guns and the men which will ultimately subvert the entire nation? And it is on this issue that the Lebanese government is digging in its heels. What has it been saying in Cairo or wherever it has been meeting with other Arab officials? We will give the guerrillas the freedom that they require, but we will not do anything which will affect our national sovereignty and our integrity. Why must they say that? Because their survival as an independent nation depends upon this. So the basic issue which is being fought out in Lebanon today is not an issue between Lebanon and Israel, or between a Lebanese government which is neutralist and pacifistic, and an Arab governments which want the war now. It's an issue between which Lebanon is facing an Arab world which is really determined on her political destruction. And indeed, we ought to, I think, be rather skeptical of this image which is building up in our public press, which portrays to us a Lebanon which is neutral, pacifistic. Christian churches, it would be called Christian. Unwilling really to go along with the war against Israel, going along only because someone is twisting its arm, forcing her to. If any of the wars against Israel would have succeeded, the Lebanese army, I assure you, would have marched in the triumphal procession. The Lebanese were among the original founders of the Arab League. The Lebanese fought tooth and nail to prevent the proclamation by the United Nations of a partitioned Palestine. The Lebanese, as you remember, in 1947, stopped the building of the American Arabian Oil Company pipeline at Sidon in order to bring economic pressure through the oil companies on the United States. The Lebanese Al-Kawachi, who you may remember, mounted in 1947 the first large irregular band of guerrillas who attacked the settlements of the Yishuv. And when that war was over, a war in which the Lebanese joined, he went to Beirut and openly established the first of the terrorist activities, the granddaddy of the Al-Fatah, the National Liberation Organization. The Lebanese allowed 100,000 refugees to settle in 15 camps in the Lebanon, and like every other Arab nation, they refused to allow these people to integrate into the economy. They kept them in these dismal camps, and they brought to them all the visitors and the tourists to the Middle East in order to show them the ravages that Israel had caused, the misfortune and the misery that was all Israeli. Beirut has been the center of propaganda from the Arab world directed to Europe and particularly to the United States. The American University in Beirut, with important contacts into the American Protestant establishment, has been probably the largest propaganda mill of all, next to the Arab League itself. In 1956, the Lebanese government began to allow Arab guerrillas, covertly at first, and then more and more overtly, to operate from their soil. They sent out all kinds of propaganda during 1956, which helped to precipitate the Suez campaign. They have, in other words, been part and parcel from the very beginning of every bit of major activity directed by the Arab world against Israel. They were a founding member of the embargo of all Israeli goods and have tried to accede to it and demand that governments, companies doing business with them, abide by it. American and British and French guns and tanks sent to the Lebanon as part of an attempt by the West to build up this nation have found their ways into the hands of those who are actively shooting against Israel. In the last 2 years, the guerrillas have had complete freedom of movement along the Lebanese-Israeli border. And the Syrians, who are cowards, the cowards of the Middle East, who prefer to attack either through the Jordan or through the Lebanon so that they will not have retaliation directly against them. The Syrian guerrillas, the Al-Fatah, have been among the most active in coming down the mountain trails of the Lebanon and attacking the northern settlements through Lebanese territories. And let no one believe that because there are 53% of the Lebanese who are Christian, these Christian Arabs are any less interested in the war against Israel than the Muslim Arabs. The Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the terrorist group which was responsible for the attack on the El Al plane in Switzerland, for the attack on the El Al plane at the Athens airport, for the bombing of the houses in Haifa 2 weeks ago, for the bombing of the marketplace, the Supersol supermarket in Jerusalem 2 months ago, is an organization founded 16 years ago by Christian Arabs in the Lebanon It remains today largely an organization of Christian Arabs, and like the El Fatah, it maintains in Beirut, quite openly, a very, very important center for its guerrilla activities. The issue then, I submit, is not simply that Israeli retaliation the last 6 months of the last year against attack from the Lebanese border has forced finally the Lebanese to try to move out the guerrillas from their territory in order to protect themselves, precipitating the events of the last days. But rather the issue is that during the last months, as more and more guerrilla bands became armed in the Lebanon, as the Lebanese began to recognize that these 15 camps which they had maintained for the last 20 years, the refugees, had turned into armed camps of saboteurs prepared to fight against the Lebanese themselves. The pressures began to mount for a contest of power between those who would subvert and those who would maintain. And what you have is an Arab-Arab civil war in which the Israeli element may perhaps be a minor catalyst, but which is essentially irrelevant. This attack on the Lebanon would be taking place perhaps not now, perhaps 6 months from now, perhaps a year from now, whether or not the Israeli issue was in fact mixed in. After Lebanon, what? Who will win? What will be won? Can the Lebanese maintain their independence? For how long? These are the questions no one can really find answers to. It seems as if the Lebanese will be able to compromise their way out of the present situation. But it seems also that the guerrillas have already taken two or three key points which control the supply roads, the Ho Chi Minh trails between Syria and the Lebanon, so that the Lebanese guerrillas are able now to get all the supplies, the heavy equipment, the artillery, and the mobile cannon which they require. It would seem that they are weaker than they were 2 months ago, but how much are they weakened? When will the next attack take place? No one really knows. It would seem to me that the first victims of these events of the last several weeks will be the 3,000 Jews who remain in Beirut. The Beirut Jewish community numbered some 6,000 people. The Lebanese government allowed those who wanted to leave immediately after the Six-Day War to leave. And 3,000 got what were called laissez-passer, allow them to leave papers. 3,000 chose, for one reason or another, to remain. Or rather, the Lebanese government was quickly put under pressure by the Arab governments and was forced to say that these people could continue to leave only if the organized Jewish community of the Lebanon would underwrite any bad debts or financial losses which they may have. And one suddenly had to pay large bribes in order to be able to leave. Now, this Beirut community knows very well that just 50 miles away in Baghdad and Damascus also, the Jewish communities are bottled up in their homes in daily physical danger. They know that all the males in Iraq have been thrown into jail. They live under constant tension, and certainly as a result of the events of the last few weeks, the tensions, the pressures will increase. Many will remain constant and will find their way out, we hope, in the next years. Some, interestingly, are under such pressure, especially the young. And we're beginning to see in the Lebanon a rather heart-rending phenomenon. And that is that a few of the young Jews of the Lebanon, raised in a world in which their status is lower than the low, subjected constantly to the pressure and the propaganda of the Arab governments, in order to prove themselves Lebanese. Has not my family been a citizen of Beirut, lo, these last 600 years? Have turned to becoming among the most fervent propagandists of the El Fatah, of the guerrillas themselves. And we've had two or three of these young people traveling throughout Canada, they've traveled into Europe, proclaiming themselves to be Jews who talk about the evils, the despicable cruelties and evils of Zionism. One sympathizes with the pressures which brought them to this point. One must still attack them for the lies that they spread. What will be after Lebanon. I think Lebanon represents a turning point in Arab propaganda in the United States. I think for the first time, the Arabs will have in the United States an issue on which they can trade for a great deal of support. But make no mistake about it, the interest of the established churches in the United States, particularly of the Protestant churches in the Lebanon, is great. There's a tremendous financial and emotional investment in the Christianization of the Lebanon. There are personal ties and others. And it will be easy for many to say, the Lebanese went under because of Israel. How much is the United States willing to pay as a price for its continued support of Israel? Will allow these people to be thrown to the wolves? And there are those who want to be told this and want to believe this. And the reason I began as I did to emphasize that the pressures and the problems on the Lebanon are really irrelevant to the Israeli-Arab conflict is because I think it's important for American Jews to be able to make this point clear. It has not been made clear in the public press. To make it clear that the issue would face Lebanon were there no Israel. The existence of Israel may have hastened the issue and beclouded it. But the presence of a Western-oriented, commercial, capitalist, Christian state is as much an affront to most Arabs as is the existence of Israel itself. Now, we have, in the last 3 or 4 years, begun to hear more and more about the anomalous position of the Protestant church in America, particularly vis-a-vis Israel. You remember after 1967, after the war, there was a great deal of talking in the public press by rabbis and others complaining about the silence of the Christian pulpit about the events of the last months. How when Israel was threatened with genocidal war, with jihad, the Arab proclamation of that ultimate monstrosity, a holy war, the Christian pulpits largely were silent. And many talked, I think, quite correctly, that all the years of brotherhood dialogue had been meaningless because Protestantism and Catholicism, too, had not accepted the continuing validity of the Jewish people. The existence of Israel was a reproach to so many hundreds of centuries of their theology. Some of you may have read the interesting article which was published last week in our papers by Dr. Kinsolving, in which he said, the position of many Protestants on Israel must be even more galling to Jews. For if Israel is outvoted 20-1 in the United Nations, it fares even worse in the World Council of Churches, where it has no representation whatsoever. Further, there are numerous former missionaries to Arab lands who form an eloquent and widespread network for Arab propaganda, much of it originating in the Presbyterian-founded American University of Beirut. Strong Arab supporters like the Reverend Humphrey Walls of New York Presbytery, and the Reverend Harry Dorman of the Division of Overseas Ministries of the National Council of Churches continually attack Israel. And such denominational journals as Presbyterian Life, the Episcopalian, the Lutheran, and the United Church Herald continue to publish the bitterly anti-Israel writings of F.A.C. Forrest of Toronto and currently of Beirut, but they deny equal space for opposite points of view. Perhaps the most prestigious of all anti-Israel clergy is the pastor of Washington's National Presbyterian Church, the Reverend Edward Lee Roy Elson. Last month, in his $9 million church, Dr. Elson, who was also the chaplain of the United States Senate, allowed the press attaché of the Jordanian embassy to deliver a slashing attack upon Israel, as well as upon what he called, quote, the Zionist-dominated U.S. press. Dr. Elson's congregation includes 8 U.S. senators, the Chief Justice Warren Burger, and J. Edgar Hoover. Now, if the Lebanon goes under, or if the Lebanese must make major concessions which will only increase the viciousness and the intensity of the anti-Israel propaganda, which is fed through the American University and other sources from the Lebanon into the United States, it seems to me that we are going to be under greater and greater political pressure. Because essentially what these people are going to try and say is this. Israel is there, to be sure. But Israel has committed crimes, look at the refugees. and Israel is, after all, just another state. American support of Israel is undermining every American interest in the Middle East, particularly now the interest in Lebanon. How much can we allow this support to undermine what we hold dear? After all, I have a mission which I've invested $1 million. I have a jewelry factory. I have a perfume outlet. I have a bank in which I've invested tens of millions of dollars. There's an oil outlet from Aramco. There's an oil outlet from the British American Oil Company along the Lebanese coast. Can I afford to have these outlets fall into Syrian, Russian hands? How much will I lose? When this pressure begins to build up, we're going to have to counter it with facts and with information and with pressures of our own. In particular, we're going to have to talk tachlis, Turkey, with our clerical and ecclesiastical confreres, because most of them are unaware of the basic issues. They live in a world which is limited to what their own concerns. Israel is not one of them. The American University is. Collections are taken for the American University in Beirut and every Presbyterian church in the city of Cleveland every year. And we're going to have to step up our informational campaign with these people and hopefully break the controls, if we can, of those who are misinformed or who deliberately misinform. To give you a sense of the mood of the many in the Protestant church today, let me read you part of a report prepared a week ago or two ago by Dr. Franklin Littell. Dr. Littell is an old-time friend of Israel. He's one of the great theologians in the Protestant church. He's a Lutheran, and he's a Methodist, I'm sorry. He used to be dean of the Chicago Theological School. He's now president of Iowa Wesleyan. He will talk of other things in this report, but I think the whole picture will come clear to you. Not only are Christians, Muslims, Druzes, Baha'i, Jews, etc., equally secure in Israel against persecution, not only are the holy places open to all without preference, the degree of interfaith dialogue which has developed is remarkable. It's remarkable in the first place because most of the traditional Christianity in the Holy Land is repulsive, coming from the very lowest levels of Christendom. The Greek, Armenian, and Roman financial exploitations of the holy places and the arrogant and insensitive Hebrew missions of the so-called evangelical Protestantism. It would be gain for Christianity, pure and undefiled, if the Israeli government would simply expel the Christian money changers and bigots from the country. On the contrary, the greatest care has been taken by Israel's government to protect these offices and agencies and the property rights they acquired during the dissolution of the Ottoman Empire. Even though the record of Muslim and Christian nations has been one of persecution and murder of Jews across the centuries, and especially in recent times, several Jewish leaders have taken the lead in establishing interfaith dialogue groups. Of these, the most important are the Rainbow Group, the Jerusalem Ecumenical Studies Group, and the Ecumenical Theological Research Fraternity in Israel. Certain Christian leaders with whom we talked, notably Dr. G. Douglas Young of the Institute of Holy Land Studies and others, are worthy representatives of Christians' concern and can be trusted theologically and politically. Their views, theologically sound and politically responsible, contrast markedly with the tragic betrayal of both faith and democratic politics by the Beirut Mission Center, which has become nothing but a pumping station for Arab League Muslim Holy War propaganda for the destruction of Israel and the Jews. It goes on later. The military situation remains critical. Israel is desperately outclassed in materiel and in numbers, though not in leadership and competent manpower. Communist and Arab League aggression is constant. Cultural anti-Semitism in England and France is evident in its practical effects, including de Gaulle's dishonesty in taking payment on mirages and not delivering. American policy has been largely influenced by the oil companies. As militant black leadership goes ethnic, it tends to become vocally anti-Jewish. The radical right in America is endemically anti-Semitic. In spite of UN and other verbal guarantees of Israel's existence, the Arab League governments, feudal despotisms or fascist dictatorships, and at least one Iraq, fascist internally and communist in its foreign affairs, have continued their declarations of war for more than 20 years. Three times they have tried to destroy Israel. The third time they proclaimed a holy war to kill all Jews, a second Holocaust, as the Jews rightly termed it. In this crisis, The Christian churches failed miserably to respond to the seriousness of the situation, as they had also failed at the time of the first Holocaust. The General Board of the National Council of Churches of Christ released an utterly irresponsible, indeed frivolous, statement on July 7, 1967. Only the Dutch Protestant Church treated the crisis with appropriate theological and political care. There is unfortunately no reason to feel that a fourth attack, for which the Russians have already supplied the equipment, would arouse a more serious response outside the Jewish communities. That's the concern in the Lebanon. Israeli security will not be undermined. The border has been open to the guerrillas for the last several years. But another propaganda front has been opened. And we who are concerned with the survival of Israel and with the speaking of the truth, we had better be clear in our own minds as to the validity of the cliches being offered. We better have facts with which to counter heat. We better have information with which to counter a tendentious argument. We better make sure that in our dealing with our non-Jewish friends and neighbors, when the words which betray ignorance are spoken, we counter them with information and with fact. Because in large measure, the security of Israel begins in the understanding of the American people. As the world has spun and turned, Israel, which largely won its independence with Russian arms, financed through the Czechs, has found itself increasingly dependent upon American arms and American will. And ultimately, the decisions made in Washington to supply new planes, to supply new tanks, or not to supply them, to supply grants and aid, or not to supply them, to let Israel be frittered away and cut down little by little through negotiation, or to encourage Israel to remain strong, to demand direct negotiations. Ultimately, these decisions are critical. And ultimately, the political decisions in the United States depend upon the will and the understanding of the American people. And we cannot appeal simply on the basis of our interest in Israel. We must appeal upon the vested interest of the United States in a democracy, in freedom, in an experiment to which it has been bound these many years, and in terms of countering the specious arguments of those who have special and privileged reasons to be arguing as they do. Our neighbors are not our enemies, but our neighbors are largely ignorant of our concern, and it is up to us to give them the understanding they require. After Lebanon went, the Middle East has entered a long tunnel. No one can see what light yet will come at the end of that tunnel. There are no panaceas. There are obviously no quick solutions. No one can say, here's the way, take it. The hour, the day, the years cry out for steadiness, for the steadiness of Klal Yisrael, for the Jewish people there and here. But it is a steadiness which must be active, alert, concerned. That's your responsibility and mine, to understand, to espouse, and to inform. Amen.